Welcome to the ISO Manila 2015 podcast. This podcast contains live recording from ISO Manila 2015, which took place in Impact Hub, Manila, Philippines on July 10 to 11, 2015. We will be featuring guest speakers on various startup topics from all over the world. So whether you attended it or not, here is your chance to learn from the best in the industry. On this episode, we'll be hearing from Paris de l'Etat. Paris is the Managing Director of Venture Labs at IE or IA Business School in Madrid, Spain. He spent over 20 years in investment banking and venture capital, mainly at UBS Bank and ABN AMRO. Since 2005, he has continued to be in the business of either raising funds, setting up new companies, or selling or buying companies through his group, Amazing Lab AG. He has a keen interest for what makes an entrepreneur and what he or she needs to succeed. In particular, he has focused on venture capital, digital marketing, sports management, renewable energy, and new technology industries. So there you have it, guys. Mr. Paris de l'Etat.
All the way from Spain here to the Philippines, just to talk here at ISO Manila. Thank you very much. He's the managing director from IE Venture Labs, Paris de l'Etat. Welcome on stage.
Thank you. It's great to be here in Manila. The last three times I've come, there have been typhoons. But I can't complain. I know my name sounds a little bit French, but I'm not French. I'm sorry. I think you can tell where I'm from. But my grandparents were Swiss, and that's why I have this strange name. Paris is actually a Greek name. It's not very popular to be Greek anymore, but let me tell you, as I was introduced, I run the Venture Lab at IE Business School. I'm a professor there as well. You'll be hearing quite a bit about that later on as I present to you this first plenary speech. All right, so I'm going to talk to you about my research. Okay, I have a PhD in business, and what I'm going to talk to you about today is essentially what I've been researching for the last 8 years almost. Let's get started. Does anybody recognize this guy? I'll give you a hint. He doesn't do Nespresso commercials. He didn't get married in Venice last year. It's not George Clooney. But he's a world champion in a sport. What sport do you think he's a world champion in? Something like swimming, right? He's a surfer. Next. This is him in the middle of the screen. He rode the biggest wave in the world in Portugal 2 years ago. 150 feet. Do you think he's comfortable with uncertainty? Very comfortable with uncertainty. I want you to think about yourself. Are you comfortable with uncertainty? Think about it. What does an entrepreneur see when he or she sees uncertainty? Opportunity. Exactly. But what do most people see? Risk, fear. Now, I want you to think about two things. Think about your relationship with uncertainty in your professional life, and think about it in your personal life. Try to separate the two for a minute. Next. I talk about people's relationship with uncertainty in terms of their comfort zone. Because when you're outside of your comfort zone, you're in an uncertain situation. And a lot of people are not comfortable outside of their comfort zone. And they fear fear. Next. Now, I'm not a typical academic. Okay? And the reason why I studied and I did research on what I studied is because I actually lived this. I've been through this. And I'm going to tell you very briefly a bit of my story. 1968. I don't think anybody here was born in 1968, right? Well, I was 8 years old in 1968. And I was a fairly shy guy, very introverted, didn't like to play with kids. So my mother convinced me to sell lemonade outside of our front lawn. I grew up in Los Angeles, California, and every weekend I was selling lemonade. Next. Now, it's common in America also to deliver the paper. I was a paper boy between the ages of 13 and 16. Every day at 5:30 in the morning, a truck would arrive in front of our house, and my mother and I would put rubber bands around newspapers, and I would pack my bicycle and deliver the paper for a couple of hours before going to school. Next. Well, this is not me, okay? But I looked a lot like this. I don't know if you remember, back in 1978, it was like in style to have long hair. Well, I had long hair, and I had glasses, and I had a mustache. Now, look at my curriculum. BA in mathematics. All right? I'm from Los Angeles, but I decided that Los Angeles was too warm to study, so I went to Boston. Got a BA in mathematics, then I did my master's work in computer science. I got, in 1984, the Kodak Award for Excellence in Computer Science. That today might seem like a loser award, right, Kodak? But in those days, Kodak was a big company. I was proud of that. And I got my first job programming at Oracle as a programmer. So what's the best way to describe me? I was a nerd. I was a complete nerd. I hated uncertainty in my professional life. I hated sales, marketing. When people told me, oh, I do sales, I was like, what is that? I mean, did you study for that? So there I was, very nerdy. Next. Now, again, this is not me, and this is not my girlfriend, but when I was 17, I had my first girlfriend in Los Angeles. Things were a little slow back then. And there I was, we were going out for 6 months. I was in the football team. And after 6 months of going out, she comes to me and she says, Paris, we got a problem. And I'm like, what's the problem? She says, well, you see, I said, well, did we have a fight? No, but you see, that's part of the problem. What do you mean? You see, my friends, they all have boyfriends, they have fights, they cheat on them. There's excitement. I said, what? Yes, you're like a straight line. You're so predictable. Predictable? What do you mean? Well, let me give you an example. When you tell me you're going to call me at 8 o'clock, what time do you call me? 8 o'clock. Why don't you call me at 8:10? Those 10 minutes are beautiful for a woman. Will he call? Won't he call? The anxiety of life. You're like so predictable. I've had it. I'm bored. I couldn't believe it. This girl left me because I was too predictable. Well, Bonnie, that's her name, broke my heart at the time. I hope she found the uncertainty that she was looking for in her personal life. But at the time, I realized that being a nerd in your personal life was also sometimes not a good thing. So there I was, a nerd in my personal life, a nerd in my professional life. I hated uncertainty. And here I was in Boston at age 22, working at this computer company at Oracle, and I get a call from a friend of mine in New York City. And he says, Paris, this is a very rich guy that owned big department stores, and he had a small venture capital fund. And I was a programmer. He says, Paris, I've started the small venture capital fund. I need a head of sales. I said, sales? I mean, look at that guy. You think a nerd like that can sell? He said, Paris, I know you're a nerd, but I trust you. I want you to come to New York City, and during 6 months, I will train you to be a, you know, kick-ass in sales. So I said, well, give me a few days to think about this. Now, even though I was a nerd, I realized that if you wanted to make money in life, you're not going to make money being a nerd working as a programmer, unless you're like Bill Gates or somebody. So I said to myself, I've got to learn business if I want to make money. So I was really tempted by this idea. I talked about it with my dad, and he was like, what? I spent a fortune on your career so that you could become like, you know, Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. And here you are, you want to go to New York City and do what? Marketing and sales? Well, make a long story short, I decided to quit. I quit the company, I rented a U-Haul truck, I moved to New York City, and I started the training program. Now, this was not a typical training program. Next. He had me doing 3 months of telemarketing and 3 months of face-to-face sales. Have any of you done telemarketing? Do you think a nerd is good at telemarketing? What do people do when nerds call them on the phone? They hang up on them. Well, let me tell you, here I was, Andrew, which was my boss, he picked me up at my new apartment, and he took me to this place, which is about the size of this room. There were 100 young people all over the place, on the phone, calling all over America, selling encyclopedias. And there I was thinking, oh my God, I was like 24 years old, everybody was like 17 or 18, and they were all in jeans and t-shirts. I was in a suit. I thought I was going to some training program. So Andrew says to me, you're going to sit here next to Dennis. Dennis is a 17-year-old dropout who is on the phone making calls. And there's a big board right up against the wall. And Andrew says to me, you see this board? The people who have sold the most encyclopedias this week, the top 10 appear on the board. Andrew says to me, I'm going to come here once a week and look at the board. I want to see your name on that board. I was in a panic. So I sit on the desk. I got Dennis next to me. And I listen to Dennis. Dennis picks up the phone. Hello, good morning. What's your name? Sally? Sally, have I got a deal for you? We are running a 10% discount. And I'm listening to this and I'm like, oh my God, I will never be able to speak this empty talk. Well, sure enough, there I was for a whole week. Everybody I would call would hang up on me. My name was not on the board, as you can imagine. So Andrew arrives after a week. He looks at the board, doesn't see my name, doesn't even look at me, and leaves. And the whole room starts to laugh. Because Andrew's this little guy that comes in a limousine, you know, he's training me, and he looks at the board. So everybody's laughing, I'm laughing. You know, it was funny. The second week, the same thing. Third week, I'm not laughing anymore. So I said to myself, listen, I may be a nerd, I may be, you know, I'm not very proud, but I'm not a loser. I'm not a quitter. I've got to find a way to learn this stuff. So I looked at Dennis and I said, Dennis, can I pay you to teach me this empty talk, this, you know, sales stuff? He said, okay. At night, can we like train? Sure. And he said, Paris, you need to relax. You're too uptight. This is a game. Don't, you know, look at this as yourself. So sure enough, Dennis started to teach me. And I'll never forget, there I was, week number 5. I'm on the phone with a lady in Cincinnati. And I'm telling her about the encyclopedias. I was like happy because we'd been on the phone for like 5 minutes and she hadn't hung up on me. And like after like 4 minutes, she says to me, okay, I'll take it. I go, really? The whole room was like, quiet, wait. And sure enough, she bought it. Everybody stood up and they applauded. I was so excited. But my name wasn't on the board. But Andrew came that week, didn't see my name, and he left. And you know what? No one laughed because they knew I was on my way. And sure enough, week number 8 of these 12 weeks, I was number 9 on the board. And I'll never forget that day. I had sold like one a day for the whole week. Andrew walks in, sees my name for the first time 8 weeks. He looks for me, sees my name, looks for me, smiles, and goes like this. And I started to cry. I couldn't believe it. I said to myself, I've changed as a person. Here I am, and for the first time, I'm comfortable with the uncertainty of like picking up the phone and speaking to a stranger. So I won't bore you with the rest of the details, but it was hell for me during these 3 months. But at the end of the 3 months, I was number 2 on the list. I was selling like 5 encyclopedias a day. I was feeling great, but now came the time for the tough one, face-to-face selling. How many of you are in face-to-face selling? Anybody in sales? A few of you, huh? Okay. Well, you know that that's tough. You know, here, a nerd can hide behind a phone, but you cannot hide when you're face-to-face. I was going to be working in a financial service firm, a venture capital fund. I needed to be able to sell face-to-face, Andrew said to me. So I said, okay. So I was thinking he's going to take me to a bank to do practice. I wish. Well, he picked me up the following Monday, and he takes me to Central Park South, 21st floor, this company called the American Millionaires Club. I'll never forget this day. It was a boardroom about the size of this area here. Do you remember the VHS tapes? The whole wall was covered with VHS tapes. And this guy arrives. I'll never forget this guy. He had 2 watches, open shirt, gold chain, greasy hair, gold tooth. And he says to me, good morning, son. Barry Barracuda. And I'm like, Barry Barracuda? Yes. So I sit down and he says to me, do you know what we do here? I said, I have no idea. Andrew, my boss, is sitting next to me. He's not even looking at me. He's looking the other way. He says, This is New York City. We have 18 million people here. But do you know that 3 million of these people are dysfunctionally single?
Really?
Yes. They're either schizophrenic, bipolar, all kinds of things, married 3 or 4 times. We only know one thing for sure.
I said, what's that?
They have a pet.
Oh, a pet.
Okay. Well, what we do is we actually go out, send flyers to these millions of people, and invite to send to their home a relationship analyst, someone who's going to convince them that if they become a member of our club, they will be able to see videos, 30-minute videos, on people they can meet. So before they meet them, they can see them and get to know the people, you know, get to know their interests and all kinds of things. A way of breaking the ice before someone meets somebody. And I go to him, is this legal? He looks at me, this is 1982, Barry Barracuda. He looks at me and he says, Paris, in the future, people will meet this way. This is before the internet. Today, 4 out of 10 marriages in Europe are people who've met online first. Well, at the time, I thought this was like illegal, you know. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, so why am I here? He says, well, Andrew told me you're going to be a relationship analyst. What? Yes, I'm going to send you 3 times a day to meet single people. You're going to spend an hour with them trying to figure out why they're single, breaking the bread, getting their trust. After you've done that, you're going to convince them that if they could find out about someone through a VHS tape before they actually meet them, they'll probably be more likely to find their better half. And then in the last half hour, you have to get their credit card number and close the deal. $1,500 for 1 year. Once you've got their trust. I was like, oh my God. Andrew was not even looking at me. I said, I gotta go. I'm sorry, this is not for me. We went downstairs to the Drake Hotel and Andrew sat down with me and he said, Paris, you've got 2 alternatives. You either take this or you go back to Boston. You have to learn to sell. The only way you can sell in life is if you gain the trust of the person in front of you. And the only way you can sell in life is when you believe what you're selling. And this is the best way for you to do that. Because it's true, these people are single, and through that process, you can actually give them a better chance of meeting someone. Well, I thought this was crazy. I was just imagining what my father was going to say after spending the fortune he spent on my education if I told him I was doing this. But I decided to try it. And I'll never forget this. The next day, I go into the office, and they give me my first ticket. It says, Betty Sullivan, 345 Park Avenue, age 78. I thought I was going to die. Betty Sullivan. So I walk over to 345 Park Avenue. It wasn't very far. It's a beautiful building with a doorman. And I go, I'm looking for Betty Sullivan. The doorman sends me up to the 21st floor. I arrive there, this beautiful old lady with red hair. She says, good morning, Paris. And she lets me in. She gives me coffee, cookies. And she says, so Paris, why are you here? I'm like, I don't know. Tell me about yourself. I was like, so she tells me her story. She's a ex-actress from Hollywood who had retired at the age 60 in New York. She spent 18 years now trying to find a husband, and she didn't want to die or spend the rest of her days alone. So she was looking for help. So at the end of all this, I said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I know I feel terrible about this. And she was like, okay. So she let me go, and I went back to the office, and I said, Barry, forget it. I've had it. She says, what happened? Well, I mean, you know, I went to see this lady. I told him the story. He goes, Paris, you're an idiot. Do you know how much Betty Sullivan's apartment costs? I said, I don't know. $3 million. Do you know how much Betty Sullivan spends probably every weekend on a dinner? $1,500. Do you know how many VHS tapes I have on the wall of men over the age of 78? More than 300. She could have met her match. You're a fool. Well, I won't extend this, but I had 3 nervous breakdowns during these 3 months. I was going crazy. I was crying in the shower. It was terrible. But at the end of the last, month, I was selling 2 a day. And I fulfilled this whole thing. I finished, I was one of their top salespeople, and I finished the whole program. I joined Andrew in his venture capital fund, and he didn't make me a salesperson, he made me head of sales. Within 6 months, I
was selling so many limited partnerships in New York City that I got a call from a headhunter in Wall Street. And he says, Mr. Delatraz, a managing director of Union Bank of Switzerland would like to meet you. They've heard that you're good in sales. So I go see him. I didn't know what this was about. You know, I'd never been in a bank before. And they interview me for 2.5 hours. And after 2.5 hours, this head of investment banking at the bank, he looks at me and he says, boy, Paris, you know, I don't know where you learned to sell. I didn't tell him, obviously. But you can sell. So he gave me a piece of paper and he said, this is your salary if you start on Monday. I thought I was going to die. I said, I'm sorry, but I can't leave the place I'm at, you know, Andrew. And so he said, think about it. So I walked back all the way from Wall Street back to Midtown where Andrew was, and I told him the story. And Andrew was a good friend. And he said to me, Paris, listen, this is your future. Go for it. You know? And to make a long story short, I left Andrew next, and you can imagine that I was forced out of my comfort zone repeatedly during this time. Repeatedly. And I was, because that's what happened to me during those 3 months, 6 months of training. I left Andrew and I joined UBS. I spent 20 years in investment banking. 10 years at UBS and almost 11 years at ABN AMRO Bank. Now, all my life, I have been a Monday person. There are two types of people in the world, Monday people and Friday people. Do you know what Friday people are like? These are the ones that Thursday, they're smiling because they hate their work. It's like, I hate that feeling because I love what I do. But the world is full of Friday people. Probably a lot of you here are Friday people, right? Well, here I was. I turned 42 and I became a Friday person. I had joined the second oldest profession in the world, banking. It was starting to feel like the oldest profession in the world. And I said to myself, I gotta get out of here. And all of a sudden, I get a call from Japan, from an executive at Sony. He says, Paris, Manchester United has just canceled our game with Sony, friendly match tour in Japan. So we need to find another team. Can you find me an entrepreneur that can help us bring a team to Japan? I said, I don't know anything about football. So that night, I couldn't sleep. I said to myself, this is my opportunity. The next day, I resigned from the bank. I was at the top of my career. I had 55 people working for me. I was making a fortune. I had a car and a driver. But I said to myself, I'm not happy doing this. I sold everything. I moved to Spain, and I started a sports marketing company. Next. And in 2004, I took the Valencia football team, which was the Champions League champion, to Japan. Nobody knew Valencia in Japan, so I brought Koyuki, the actress from The Last Samurai, to Valencia so all of Japan could see her. That's Rafa Benitez. He's now the coach at Real Madrid. He used to be the coach at Valencia. Well, this was a little company I started. I mean, we didn't make much money at all, but it was a lot of fun. Next. I also then took in 2005, 6, and 8, Barcelona to Japan. For 5 years, I was the biggest promoter of European soccer in Japan. Look at the smile on that nerd's face. I was happy again. I was a Monday person again. Next. So I had 5 startups during this time. Next. Even a video game company I lost a lot of money with. Next. 5 startups, 2 I lost a fortune in, completely failed, and the other 3 didn't do too bad. So after 9 years of being an entrepreneur, I said to myself, I hate this. So my friend said, what are you going to do? I want to become a professor. So this friend of mine looked at me and said, Paris, most people, when they change careers, they make more money. I mean, you go from investment banking to entrepreneur to professor. Next. So, next. When you do a PhD, you've got to do it on something. And I decided to do my PhD on the relationship of people with uncertainty. Next. And I call these people quants. These are people that don't like leaving their professional comfort zones. Remember me when I was in Boston? Going to New York? That's how I was. They struggle with ambiguity. Sometimes they're mathematically minded. They're obsessed with objectivity. These are people that insist on certainty in their work. A lot of you here are probably quants. Next. I did this for 6 years. I worked on my PhD. 155 people in all these companies. I even went to West Point to study the military. Next. So ask yourself, do you experiment at work?
Is your mind open? How comfortable are you with uncertainty professionally? Next, are we born this way? I mean, look at me when I was born. I was a baby nerd. Do you think we're born this way? Now, my sister, next, she wasn't born that way at all. She had an open mind. No, we're not born this way. They've researched hundreds of kids. They took five-year-old kids, and they saw that 97% of them were creative. They followed the same five-year-old kids until they were age 15. Only 12% were creative. What happens to us between the ages of 5 and 15? Education. Next. We're not looking for certainty as babies. Next. We're very comfortable with uncertainty. Next. Now, isn't it ironic, though, that the world is increasingly uncertain, but we are trained in our schools for a predictable world? That's why so many people are completely lost when they graduate. Next. Now, what's the best way to get comfortable with uncertainty? To force people out of their comfort zone. That's what happened to me in New York, right? For 6 months, I was forced out of my comfort zone professionally. Next. So where should you be on this scale professionally? Comfortable with uncertainty. Because those are the types of people that companies want to hire today. People like Google. They want people that think like entrepreneurs, that embrace uncertainty. You want people in your company that when they see an uncertain situation, they see opportunity, not fear. Next. But the question is, where should you be at the personal level? And this is the crux of my study. Now, when I went to New York and I became so comfortable with uncertainty professionally, do you think I changed as a person? No. I was still calling my girlfriends at 8 o'clock. Why should I? And you see, this is the point here, people. Too many of us, we use our personality, our culture, our religion, our training, our character as an excuse. We're introverts, we're shy, whatever we are. We use it as an excuse to not develop ourselves professionally. I could have stayed in Boston as a nerd, professionally and personally, but I decided to grow. I didn't decide. Finally, Andrew, I was lucky, took me and in 6 months completely opened my mind professionally. And it did not affect who I was as a person. This is a very important message in Asia, because in Asia, a lot of people, especially in countries like Japan, Korea, and the like, they're coming from cultures where they are very introverted or very uncomfortable with uncertainty in their personal lives. And they struggle professionally many times because some people say to them, you want a Silicon Valley mentality? You need to go have a Hollywood person to go with it. And that's not true. You can keep your character, your values, the way you are and still grow professionally. Next. This is the comfort zone scale that we have developed. A professor at UC Berkeley and myself, and now we're coming out with a book this fall. We're actually, and one of the things I was here doing in Manila is we're going to be rolling out this research across Asia with the different schools because we want to interview as many people as we can. We've now already interviewed 3,000 people. But imagine this. When I was in Boston, I was a P1W1. Hated uncertainty in my personal life. Hated it in my professional life. When I went to New York, I became a P1W4. Today, I'm a P2W4. I'm a little less nerdy. But I was in Japan a few weeks ago for a week. I went to the same restaurant every night. Why not? Why should I change? Why should I like experiment if I like the place? So think about this. Where are you on this scale? Where was Steve Jobs on this scale? Anybody know? Anybody want to guess Steve Jobs, where he is on this scale? W4 and the P? P1. P1, W4. Steve Jobs hated uncertainty in his personal life. He denied it. And he was a P4, a W4. Now, I teach in Japan a lot. In Japan, there are many people, executives, that are P1, W1s. And they want to become P1, W4s. We can teach people to move across the W scale. Trying to teach people to move across this scale is very difficult. I did this talk in Sao Paulo a few weeks ago, and you know, a lady came up to me after the conference, and she said, Professor, I'm a P4. How can I become a P2 again? I said, see me after class. No. Can you become a P2 again? I said, I don't know. If you're a P4, you don't fear uncertainty in your personal life anymore. Now, you may decide, you're married now with 3 kids, that you want to live the life of a P2. Because you've been there. You don't want to, you know, you don't fear it, but you don't want it. As a P2, I have fears in my personal life. As a W4, there's nothing I fear. Next. So, this is one of my favorite charts for the representation of entrepreneurship. You see, as entrepreneurs, we're always struggling and dealing with this situation, confusion, opportunity, all kinds of stuff, uncertainty. And then we see clearly. What do you notice about that line? It's what? Exactly. It's still wavy. Thank God that line is still wavy. This is the business world. If that line was straight, there'd be no opportunity. Right? And as entrepreneurs, we like that wavy line. And then it comes back here and we start all over again. But maybe in your personal life, I don't like wavy lines in my personal life. I want that line straight. Next. Opportunity is what we see, but what a lot of people see, next, they see fear. Next. We researched over 3,000 MBA and other professionals, and what did we find? Next. Well, we found the following that's very interesting. 80% of the people who are W3s and W4s, guess what they are on the P scale? P1, P2. Why do you think that people that have big comfort zones professionally, 80% of them have small comfort zones in their personal life? Why do you think? Exactly. Life is a balance for many of us. I can come here and go crazy for 5 days talking to people like you. And then I go back to Madrid and I'm like, you know, staying at home all weekend. I don't want to go out. So, this is a very important message, people, because too many young people today, and especially in Asia and in the Middle East, where I also spend a lot of time, they seriously believe that they cannot keep up with the growth economies that they're in because of the way they've been raised, the character, the religion, the culture, whatever it is. And that is definitely not the case. We can learn to become entrepreneurial thinkers without sacrificing or giving up who we are as a culture, as a people. Next. The other thing we found is that people are actually happier when they move across on the W scale because they have less fears. Next. So the bottom line here, no connection between the P's and the W's. 80% of the W3s, W4s, or P1, P2s, and over 50% of the people are actually happier when they move across. Next. Again, this is why this research is so important. Next. This was in Japan a few weeks ago. I mean, look at this guy. He's a P1. He came up to me after this class. All 5 of these came up to me and they said, Professor, we're quants. I said, yeah, I can tell. And he said to me, I'm an entrepreneur. I got 22 people working for me. But everybody is telling me that I need to change. I stay home on weekends with my girlfriend. We order in, we watch DVDs. I mean, why do I need to change? Do I need to change? I asked him, are you happy? He says, yes, I'm happy. Why should you change? The next time somebody tells you that you should change, you ask them if they're happy. I mean, maybe you could change the way you dress. I didn't say that, obviously, but why should you change if you're happy? Don't listen to these people. Nobody is telling us to stay the way they are. We've got all kinds of media, self-help books saying, you need to grow. You need to become more like this. If you're happy, consider yourself lucky, because most people are not happy. You can still grow professionally while still being who you are. Next. So ask yourself, and we're going to be rolling out, hopefully across Asia, a book, an app, a survey, because we want to interview, hopefully, thousands and thousands of people around the place. Because there's so much research that we still need to do about this, you know, the correlation with, you know, sex, with age, with income groups. But at the end of the day, our goal is very simple. Here in the Philippines, I run an app challenge, a mobile app competition, and what we're trying to do is reach out to as many people in the provinces and get them to, we're not going to touch the P's. That's not what we're about. We're touching the W's. Everybody, we need everybody, all the young people in the Philippines, to be thinking like entrepreneurs. And we need the companies to start thinking that way too. We actually, for example, at Nissan in Japan, we actually saw that the company was actually far to the left to the employees. So what happens when a company is not moving as fast as the employees want it to move? It's a problem, and it hinders growth. Next. This is one of my idols, and one of the things I love about this guy is that he was obsessed with the idea that we should not settle. A lot of people have asked me, Paris, you know, why did you leave the bank? I'm about to wrap up now. And, you know, I never had a real reason for it. And it was only a couple of years ago in Hawaii that I realized why I left the bank. There I was in church. And I don't go to church a lot on vacation, but I decided this time to go to church. And it was amazing. It was a Filipino priest in Hawaii at church. And we had the church was like full like this. And at one point he realized during the sermon that nobody was listening to him. So he started to clap and everybody was quiet. And he said, listen to me. And everybody was very quiet. I want to ask you a question. How many of you, when you die, want to go to heaven? Everybody thought it was a trick question. Of course, you're in church, right? And he said it again. How many of you want to go to heaven when you die? Everybody raised their hand. Great. So then he pretended he received a phone call, took out his cell phone, like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. So then he hung up and he said, guess who that was? That was God. And he has a deal for you. Do you know in Monopoly the get-out-of-jail-free card? Today's your day. All those sins, all those parties, forget all that. It's get-out-of-jail-free. How many of you want to go to heaven right now? Come on. How many of you want to get to heaven right now? It was so quiet. There was a little old lady in the front. She must have been like 88 years old. That Filipino priest looked at her and said, she was like some California lady that, you know, vacation in Hawaii. Aren't you ready to go to heaven, man? And the woman looked at him and said, Father, I have a lot to live still. There she was with her kid. And he smiled. And then he got up and he said to all of us, listen, someday when you're about to die, let me give you a piece of advice. It's very likely that you're not going to regret the things you've done on this earth. You're going to regret what you haven't done. So when you go out today from this mass, you go out there and live your lives. And it was at that point that for the first time in my life, I realized that's why I left the bank. If I had not left, when I left and, you know, put all that stuff, all that money and just walked away from it, I would have never done it. And I see my friends, they're still there. Next. So take it from me. Life is too short to not have a passion. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Paris de la Trois. So if you want to open your professional mind, visit and join his LinkedIn group, Accidentally Quants, and also see his TEDx talks. Follow him on Twitter at Paris de Letras, that's at Paris, DELETRAZ. For the next episode, we will be featuring Manny Ayala from Endeavor Philippines. So make sure you tune in for the next episode.